Hello and welcome to this week's Revisiting Old Favourites podcast in the Inner Sanctum. Thanks as always for joining me. We are continuing the revisiting of my own book, Merry England, A Journey Through the Shire. And should you want to follow along by looking at the book itself, and indeed there's some lovely images in the book which I can't portray in a podcast, then please check out the book itself. So it's Merry England, A Journey Through the Shire, and it's published by Tan Books. So, without further ado, we arrived in Yorkshire last week, and in fact the city of York, and we talked about the wonderful Saint Margaret Clitheroe. But now our pilgrim, our hobbit, if you like, journeying through the Shire of Merry England, arrives today at the Yorkshire Moors. The Yorkshire Moors. Bruised, no doubt, by its brutal and bloody history, the city of York resembles a proud old man. Eroded but erect, it surveys the passage of time and the fading fashions with a nonchalant wisdom. It has seen the rise and fall of modernity and awaits, with studied indifference, the post-mortem of post-modernity. Paradoxically, it is destined to be more modern than the moderns, and will witness the posterity of the postmoderns. Dignified by the decorum of a living tradition, it will linger long after these proud but preposterous impostors have passed away. It is therefore with a fondness that fosters forgiveness that a pilgrim bids the city adieu. York might have spilled the blood of the martyrs, but so had Holy Rome many centuries earlier. Cities, like people, can be forgiven their trespasses. Perhaps indeed they have been washed white in the blood of the martyrs they have slain. As the pilgrim heads north, he is struck by the peaceful serenity of the landscape that surrounds the city. The Vale of York resembles a tranquil sea, calm and unmoved by the presence of the wanderer in its midst. Soon, however, the hills rise to meet him, wave upon wave breaking upon his hungry eyes, feasting him with visual munificence. Each ascent offers the tantalizing promise of a new breathtaking horizon, and each peak keeps the promise, laying the new horizon at the feet of the breathless pilgrim. It is the gift offering of creation to the creature, prompting the latter to praise the creator. Such is the dynamic trinity of praise upon which the ascetic spirit rises to meet the aesthetically spiritual. Eventually, the pilgrim reaches that corner of Yorkshire upon which his heart has been bent since leaving the city. Arriving in the quiet, picturesque town of Pickering, he heads for the railway station. Here, to his delight, he steps back in time. This is the terminus of the North York Moors Railway, an oasis of the Age of Steam. The station itself is decorated in the manner of the 1940s, enabling the visitor to lose himself in nostalgia for a time he has never known, but that persists in his memory as a virtual reality relayed on film. The sound of the engine's whistle, the sight and feel of the old wooden railway carriages, and the smell of smoke and steam remind him insistently, through four of the five senses, of brief encounters of a bygone age. The vintage steam engine, puffing expectantly at the platform, is going to the pilgrim's destination. Preparing to rest his weary limbs, he purchases a ticket, climbs into the 1940s, and sits back to enjoy the journey. Any feelings of guilt for forsaking his feet for the comforts of less than modern technology are allayed by echoes of the words of Belloc. For who but critics could complain of riding in a railway train? If the pilgrim had not been seduced by the sensual pleasures of steam, he could scarcely resist the blister-defying bliss of surveying the rugged wonder of the Yorkshire moors through the window of the carriage. With his feet throbbing gratefully for the respite they had been given, he observes the varying vistas pass before him in stately procession, punctuated by wisps of steam and splinters of soot. He alights at Goathland, a village so sublime that only the sceptic soul could fail to fall head over heels for her charms, and only the most sceptic soiled heart could fail to give itself to her. As one who is happy not to be afflicted with these sins of cynicism, the pilgrim pays homage to her beauty in grateful genuflection. Filled with good humour and humility at finding himself in her presence, he resolves to stay with her for a couple of days. He books himself into the hotel and relaxes with a pint of the ale for which Yorkshire is rightly celebrated. Tomorrow, he muses, he will explore, not for the first time, and hopefully not for the last, the delights and pleasures of Goathland and beyond. That's actually the end of chapter 7, but we're under 7.5 minutes. So I'm going to go ahead and read chapter 8, which is actually titled with the same three words that we ended the previous chapter, Goathland and Beyond. Refreshed by one of those hearty and traditional English breakfasts that are a cardio catastrophe for the indolent, but a boon to a body emboldened by the prospect of a healthy day's hiking, the pilgrim sets off from his hotel. Fueled by bacon, eggs, tomatoes, mushrooms, toast, and several cups of tea, he feels ready for the rigours of the day. And indeed, the day promises to be rigorous. He plans to explore the moorland countryside around and beyond Goathland in a circular route that will take him to the south and the west of the village before bringing him back to the shelter of its bosom before nightfall. Descending a rugged ravine, he finds himself in a woodland valley, walking along the side of a river that serves as a tributary of the River Esk. The inkling of a distant roar on the aural horizon becomes ever louder until its source springs awesomely into view, the eyes confirming what the ears had long suspected. Malian Spout, England's largest waterfall, cascades majestically and triumphantly over the edge of the overhanging precipice. To be honest, and making full confession in distance of any patron, in defiance of any patriotic pride, the pilgrim will readily concede that it is not particularly large. Compared with the mighty cataracts of America and Africa, it is indeed a minuscule trickle, merely Malian the waterfall, F-O-O-L. In the presence of King Niagara, Queen Victoria, or the Archangel of Venezuela. Nonetheless, and as a tireless advocate of the belief that small is beautiful, the pilgrim remains resolutely impressed with Malian Minor. After all, cannot a babbling brook inspire poetry as sublime as that inspired by a rolling river or a roaring ocean? Clambering out of the valley, the pilgrim emerges onto the edge of a wide open moor, the wilderness landscape of which he is so enamoured. Accompanied only by the occasional sheep, which regard him warily but continue their grazing with nonchalant indifference, he passes in silence through the sea of heather. Now and then a grouse scurries, scared, from its hiding place and flutters flurriedly into the distance, screeching its complaint as its low trajectory finds safer ground away from trespassing feet. Following the narrow sheep paths and finding his footing fumblingly, he staggers blindly into the presence of a stag that most noble of creatures. With sinewy ease it leaps, almost flies, from his path, a brown blur blown to safety by the effortlessness of its slender grace. It is the veritable ballet dancer of the moors, putting the clumsy wings of the grouse to shame. Crossing a stepping-stoned stream, he ascends onto Wealdale Moor, where he is confronted by something as surprising as the startled stag, and something that, in its own way, is equally noble. He finds himself face to face with a paradox, a pre-medieval paradox in the midst of the primeval paradise. There, in the wilderness, in the wilds of the wilds, are the ruined remains of an ancient Roman road, shooting as straight as an arrow across the Brontean bleakness of the moor and stretching like a narrow ribbon of stone into the distance. He sees in the ruined road the relics of a long-dead civilization, and in the bold persistence of the unchanging moorland landscape, the triumph of creation. The best-laid skims of mice and men gang after glay, but the majesty of God remains. Standing on the churned and uprooted stones in the midst of the age-old highway, he can sense the presence of ghostly feet, shadowy legions marching towards the ancient fortress city of Eboracum, now known as York. He can also sense the ghostly presence of the Anglo-Saxon shop or poet who lamented the ruins of time amidst the Roman remains of his own time. For the Saxon poet and the modern pilgrim alike, the Romans remain as giants whose legacy inspires reverence. Well wrought this wall, weirds broke it, the stronghold burst. Snapped roof trees, towers fallen, the work of the giants, the stonesmiths, mouldereth. Rime scoureth gate towers, rime on mortar, shattered the shower shield, roofs ruined, age underate them. And the wielders and wights? Earth grip holds them, gone, long gone, fast in grave's grasp, sank to loam crust. In the weird presence of the ghostly Saxon muse, musing over the spirit of long-dead Roman legions, the pilgrim recalls the ruins of time and lets his mind meander into melancholy. He wends his weary way to Gothland, physically oriented, but metaphysically lost in thought. Arriving back in the village, the home of many restful memories, he faces his first serious temptation since setting out from Norfolk many days earlier. He is tempted to abandon his pilgrimage altogether, not so much because he is weary of the journey, but because he desires to stay in this secluded secret of a moorland village forever, groping and grasping for hints of permanence in the presence of the princely and unchanging hills. He pauses, ponderously and prayerfully, to pick up that part of his heart that he had left behind when he had last departed several years earlier. In a halcyon daze, he clutches it close to the rest of his restless core, parts of which pine in sympathy and in exile, dreaming of other paradisal places enshrined in memory. From uncharted depths, deep down within, he hears echoes of distant Irish shores, where waves weave their endless spell and caress the mind with crests that break with the heart's longing. He sees, as the mind's eye gazes in ultramontane reminiscence, the ripening of great draped hills in summer-drenched Tuscany. No, he is not truly at home here in the heathered haven of Gothland, any more than he is truly at home where the waves break with the heart or where the sun bathes the vines. His true home is elsewhere, somewhere he has never yet been. Ad te clamamus exules filiae Eve. To you do we cry, poor banished children of Eve. No, there is no Eden, this side of Death's Gate, merely tantalizing glimpses in the gladdening glades of glorious landscapes, of how things are meant to be, half-hidden hints of home. Qui vitem sine termino nobis donet in patria. O grant us endless length of days in our true native land with thee. In patria, our native land, our true home, the home for which we were born. Fragmented thoughts of an exiled heart, the yearning of the homeless. But no, not homeless, merely away from home. With such thoughts, the pilgrim passes from the omnipresent to the present. He realizes that he is away from home, physically, as well as metaphysically. He is on a journey, literally and allegorically. He leaves a piece of his heart behind and heads off northwards. Thanks so much for joining me in this latest Revisiting Our Favourites podcast. Please do join me next week as we continue our journey through the Shire of Merry England. Until then, goodbye and God bless.